We'll begin with a reading of the Declaration of the United Lodge of Theosophists. The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of Theosophy, without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the Theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of Theosophy and the exemplification in practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among Theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, the sole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among Theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as Theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity, without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization. And it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes, and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. The true Theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. In keeping with the principles given forth in this Declaration of the United Lodge of Theosophists, in Philadelphia, we have 3 weekly meetings, beginning on Sunday morning from 11 to 12 noon. We have a formal presentation of the philosophy in the form of a lecture, a forum, which is a shorter talk, or a panel discussion. The building opens at 10:30, as on Sunday mornings we have a hybrid type meeting, a simultaneous Zoom broadcast and a meeting at the lodge for those who are able to attend. Now, this month we have been examining the umbrella theme of psychism and spirituality. Next Sunday, May 25th, will be the last of our considerations for the month on that subject. It will be a panel format, and the subject is the path of liberation and renunciation. This Sunday, today, we are taking up the subject of the powers and responsibility of the soul. On Wednesday evenings, we have a study class in the Ocean of Theosophy. We are currently in the chapter on psychic forces and phenomena. This Wednesday, May 25th, the subject is clairvoyance and clairaudience. And those meetings begin at 7:30 and last till 8:45. And as said, that is a Zoom-only meeting. On Fridays, we have a roundtable discussion this Friday, May 27th. We are using as our text an article by William Judge called Universal Brotherhood, A Fact in Nature. And those informal roundtable discussions take place on Friday between 6:30 and 7:30, and it is also a Zoom-only meeting. For those who wish to obtain direct texts of theosophical material. Of course, it is available on the Phoenix ULT website, but you can also write to ULT Philadelphia at AOL.com, and a student will be happy to direct you to how you can purchase texts for yourself, your individual study. All the activities of this lodge are supported by voluntary contributions of time, service, and money. And if you would like to find out more how you can contribute, once again, you can write to the lodge email address. So this morning, then, we are taking up the subject of under psychism and spirituality of the responsibilities and powers of the soul, or the powers and responsibility of the soul. So as this is a forum presentation, we will have a short talk on that subject, followed by an extended period of questions and answers.
Powers and responsibilities of the soul. Theosophy is the teaching in regard to life, and as a teaching, is absolutely unique. Its specific doctrines are comparatively unknown. Hence, soul, as used in theosophy, is not generally understood, for the majority of people have only a vague idea of what is meant by the theological classification body, soul, and spirit, and therefore they assume theosophists are equally vague in their use of the term soul. However, this is not the case. What is the soul from the theosophical standpoint? It is embodied spirit. And what is embodied spirit? It is conditioned consciousness. And what is conditioned consciousness? We are. That man possesses an immortal soul is the common belief of humanity. To this, theosophy adds that he is a soul, and further, that all nature is sentient, that the vast array of objects and men are not mere collections of atoms fortuitously thrown together, and thus without law, evolving law, but down to the smallest atom, all is soul and spirit, ever evolving under the law which is inherent in the whole. And just as the ancients taught, so does theosophy, that the course of evolution is the drama of the soul, and that nature exists for no other purpose than the soul's experience. The best way for us to learn this is by using the powers that are inherent in us. For we are able to see, and even a little seeing firsthand is better than any amount of secondhand description. Using then our soul power of discernment, we can see that life is in every one of us. It is what we fundamentally are. It is not that we are alive. We are life. It is not that we are a body. Our body is only a form of matter for the soul to experience and gather knowledge. Just so, our consciousness is a form of life. For the soul is the perceiver. It is vision itself, and it looks directly upon ideas. The soul itself is unmodified, unconditioned, unembodied. Yet the moment that the soul looks upon ideas, it becomes identified with the idea on which it looks. So we can see that the soul has more powers, the power of expansion and the power of identification. We have the power of identification with any part of life, with any object in life, with any idea we may be presented with, and with any experience we may encounter in any part of life. So let's take a look at some powers we really never think about. Take, for instance, the power of magnetic sympathy, which is commonly seen in life. Two friends with strong mutual sympathy have been so throughout their lives, and then they part at death. The power of magnetic sympathy, which the two had mutually generated between them in the past, unfailingly brings the two souls back together in some future life. When they meet again, the one who had grown in wisdom and holiness has a power to touch inwardly the life of his old friend and influence him to pursue a nobler ideal in his life. Then there is the power of introspection, the detailed mental examination of your own feelings, your own thoughts and motives, and they're associated with every action, thought, word, and deed you have. The power of mind over matter, the power of the soul over the mind and desire nature, and of self-restraint. The power of concentration, the power of the will and of the imagination to create forms on all planes of form, the power of the mind generally to generate force, thought as a power to understand one's real motives, the power to trace a thought to its source, the power to discriminate between the real and the unreal, between right and wrong, the power to hear from within by making the mind receptive to higher impressions, the great power of keeping silent in speech and thought. And that one is rarely cultivated, yet it is of the first importance. Of much more value than clairvoyance and clairaudience. And there are many more powers like that of perception and expression. Some speak of the higher powers, but this is really a misnomer. The so-called higher powers are in reality simply a different use of all those we already possess. Therefore, the acquirement of higher powers is not, as we are apt to think, it is not a receiving of something from an outside source. It's not a gift from higher beings, but it is a process of evolution of the inner man himself, an unfolding and developing from within outwards of our present faculties. Transforming them from latency into activity, an expansion of knowledge of one's own true nature. In other words, spiritual growth. So is there one particular power that is more important than any others and desired by wise men and sages of all times? There is. It's discrimination, judgment, right wisdom. Good judgment, states H. P. Blavatsky, is the highest power that any man can possess. It is not really a power of possession, but that which we direct and use our powers and possessions. Greater than wealth, power, or knowledge, it is of another nature than the worldly. Some say it is the vision of the soul, a light from within, by which all things become clear and understandable. It is the responsibility and mission of the soul to learn and realize that in its higher most being, there is no individuality or separateness, but just one universal self, which we call spirit or Atman. To really become this in consciousness, to consciously merge and permanently unite the soul with the spirit, is to achieve and attain union or yoga. And this is the great goal of all. This has been the goal and achievement of all true mystics and esotericists throughout the ages, both in the East as well as in the West. There is no possible way of understanding or explaining the nature of any being, whatever, except through evolution, which is always an unfolding from within outwards. It's the expression of spirit or consciousness through the intelligence acquired. The will of spirit in action has produced everything that exists. If we understand that intelligent will lies behind everything that exists, is the cause of everything that is the creator in the universe, then we may perhaps gain some idea of what it is necessary for us to know in order to use our powers. All the experience of the past, all the civilizations that ever have been, have produced beings who are now the custodians of all the knowledge that has ever been gained. That knowledge is waiting for us as soon as we take the necessary steps to fit ourselves to become the possessors of it. That knowledge includes all the intellectual knowledge, all the spiritual knowledge, and all the knowledge of every force in nature. And in closing, as one of our great teachers said, all nature is before you. Take what you can. It is for each one to listen, to learn, and to apply. The topic for today's discussion is powers and responsibilities of the soul.
Yes, we have a question at ULT.
It was mentioned in the talk about the power of perception being the major power, so to speak. So we're wondering then, where does this idea of compassion and the imagination come in as the powers of the soul?
Question put forth is, where does compassion and imagination come in as a power of the soul? Being that perception or consciousness and awareness is certainly in general, a power of the soul. So what do we understand by what do we understand to be the meaning of the word compassion? LP?
I think it means literally with feeling. So it comes from what is awakened within us, and that's how we respond to another, with passion, with feeling. Understanding would work as well.
So we respond, the contribution here is we respond to another with feeling. So obviously, in order to do that, we have to have the power to be aware of the other as well as aware of our own feelings. But what is the nature of that feeling that we share with or respond with another being? What is that feeling?
Hey, good morning, everyone. Okay. Is an open forum to ask questions and comments?
Well, what you can do, what are your initials?
It's MUE.
Oh, okay, MUE. Yes, we see you there. If you can, are you able to raise your hand? Do you know how to raise your hand on your?
Yep, right there.
Okay, thank you. We'll come back to you in a moment. Okay. We have a response to that, ULT. Unmute, please.
Okay.
So the question had to do, compassion can mean with feeling, but do we mean feeling? Certainly compassion, we shouldn't misinterpret the idea that compassion is an emotion. It's a power of the soul. So if it's a power of the soul, then if we're feeling truly from compassion, then we have the ability, we'll recognize the ability, that we can in some way identify with the suffering of another, and based on that, recognize what we might be able to do to help them to get through it, to understand it, maybe even just give them more understanding of their situation and equip them with what's necessary for them to take a step beyond their suffering.
Was that heard, or should we restate?
No, it was heard clearly, thank you. So the contribution here is awareness or perception of the suffering of another being. And we would be aware of that suffering in the same way we would be aware of suffering in ourselves. We sense a state of dis-ease or imbalance. And we know that because we have experienced the opposite of ease or balance. So compassion then is a discriminative faculty of the soul, an ability to adjudge that something is out of balance. So there is within the soul itself wisdom of what is the nature of harmony and balance in order to see its opposite. And then there is also involved in compassion, not just the awareness, but the ability as to how to act to restore that harmony, that ease, not only within ourselves, but within another human being. So it is definitely a power of the soul, the ability to use our experience and to act in a discriminative way in order to right which appears to be wrong. Now, MUE, you have your hand up. Did you want to make a contribution on this?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for allowing me to speak. So, absolutely. I think that the initial definition that was provided of compassion was the ability to feel. And then the next definition that was provided was the ability to feel in a way by which balance was restored. And so, I actually had another reflection, but this last point, the first two points are just so amazing that I want to comment on that. And positive question is. Then it's the compassion that a mother or a parent has innately for the child often expresses itself in different ways depending on the discrimination and depending on the set and setting of what is warranted. So if it's, I find that interesting, is because there are eschatological figures in the Muslim faith that their actions outwardly may be perceived to the contrary of the actual intention behind them, which is compassion. Yes. So in order to bring balance back to imbalance, kind of like, I don't know, radiation therapy for a tumor in like a glioblastoma or something like that, outwardly it's like, well, you're blasting the brain with, you know, with lasers. But to bring the central nervous system back into balance, back into equilibrium, sometimes that does warrant outwardly something that isn't nice. So the reason why I bring this up is because I think that what I'd seen from your website is that you guys don't fall into faux spirituality. This is like real deal stuff. And so being nice, we live in a culture of being nice, but sometimes being nice is not the same thing as being kind and compassionate. And so I wanted to just open the floor up to that because the reflections are just so apropos.
Thank you very much for that contribution and question. So we have here the understanding then that imbalance or disease is not only caused by what we do, but what we do not do. And likewise, harmony can be restored by what we do or what we refrain from doing. And what we do or don't do really depends on our experience, our wisdom. And the example may be brought up with a mother and a child. Well, a mother can certainly show her compassion for the child who is unable to care for itself by giving it a protective environment and nurturing it and providing it with warmth and food and nutrient. But at another stage, when the developing infant and child has developed the powers and responsibilities to make decisions and grow on its own, it certainly would not be in this sort of the service of compassion or harmony and balance to constantly be doing things for the child that they could do for themselves. So that would be a kind of disturbance. And so the mother or parent on the outward may appear to be doing nothing, may not be jumping to the aid of the child, but willing to let the child experience suffering on their own in order that they may learn and grow and become a stronger and more self-reliant human being. And people might judge it as being nice or not nice, but really, if compassion is not really a human attribute, but really a wisdom, then it really depends on the inner motive and knowledge as to whether something is compassionate or not. Now, LP, you had your hand up for a while. You'd like to add to this?
Well, the Theosophy teaches that we are to grow in that realization of identity and treat everyone's children as we treat our own. And then we are told compassion is no attribute. It is the law of laws. And in the news lately, there have been videos that prove compassion is in the animal kingdom, not just with their own species, and then that it's in the plant kingdom, that trees choose, and that's a poor phrase, but trees make themselves available to everyone and assist in the lower kingdoms. So we see compassion everywhere, perhaps, except within ourselves at times.
So the example was given of compassion being everywhere in nature as it is a law of laws. And since compassion depends on perception or consciousness of a disease or an imbalance, we could reason from that all nature is conscious or intelligent to some degree and able to act or react, whether we call it instinctively or with self-awareness, as in the human kingdom, in a way that restores that balance. So the nature of trees were examples. So scientists have well documented that trees growing in a primeval forest, and these huge trees, as large as they are not really separate, but of a huge underground root system that intermingles, interblends with every other tree nearby. And what's remarkable is that if one tree should be suffering from a lack of light or nutrition, let's say because it is overclouded by other trees and so forth, does not get enough sunlight, that signal, that distress is somehow transmitted chemically through the root system of the tree to the mother tree or the other large trees, and they, sensing that, give out chemical signals and nutrition specifically to that tree and not to the others. So what a wonderful example of compassion, comparative to the mother who recognizes that one of her children needs one kind of help and another child may need a completely different kind of help. One may need intellectual support, one may need physical comfort, one may need food. The mother knows intuitively, or even instinctively, we might say, what each child needs, and we call it compassion. But we, as said, it's in all the kingdoms because consciousness is all-pervading, as is this law of laws. We want to get to ULT's other question on imagination. We haven't forgotten that, but MUE rather does have a follow-up question or comment. Go ahead. MUE?
Yes, sir.
I do.
Again, just incredible gratitude at these reflections. The reason being is that this community really does represent a level of thinking and cognition and presence and intentionality that in terms of like the greater society that we live in has been lost in many ways and sometimes by design. And so I wanted to actually ask you all a question. I am a clinician and I have seen that working with the most vulnerable populations in our society, that helping restore the judiciousness and the discretion and the ability to discern is, I would say, like 80 or 90% of the battle. And there are so many factors that pull people away from being able to act in their best interest. Per your all, like per a collective reflection in terms of your experience, your spiritual journeys, How do you do that? How do you impart that wisdom in a robust way when that wisdom is not sought? When one does not want what's good for them? So it's easier to do with a child, like in a primary care setting where you're dealing with a pediatric patient, or you have a very motivated patient, a patient who's like, listen, I want to lose weight, I want to stop smoking. And they do it. But the people who are like, no, I don't have a problem. So I think a succinct way of putting it is, how do you develop insight into someone that they lack discernment and then impart the sufficient motivation or inspiration to catalyze change? I think that's a succinct way to put it.
Thank you for that thoughtful question and comment. So, perhaps this would have been the first question we should have considered is, what do we mean by responsibility? What qualifies a being as being responsible? Because as we said, there is intelligence, there is compassion in all the kingdoms. And yet we would not necessarily say that a tree or an ant has a moral responsibility or a capacity for free will and choice to choose between the better and the dearer. So what is it that makes a being responsible? And that gets to the gist to our last question, because many people in our society have been raised subtly to turn away from responsibility, to place the responsibility on others and not take authority for their own decisions. So we might say the responsibility is the state of being capable of making independent decisions. Responsibility is the state of being capable of making independent decisions. And that is a distinctive quality of the human soul. And like any quality and power, that ability to make independent decisions may be there, but may not be used to the same degree and extent in others. So we all have muscles that we can move our arms with, but some of us have made the independent decision to develop the muscles of our arms, or to use the muscles of the arms and train them in such a way that others do not. So we might say that the first step we all have to realize, and a step that we can help other people realize, is the fact that they can recognize that they are capable of making independent decisions. Because when you tell them that they can do something and they decide not to do it, that's an independent decision. So even the person's neglect or refusal to follow good advice or make decisions is an independent decision. So you can point that out. Now the question then becomes, once we recognize that as souls, as human souls, as thinkers, we innately have the ability to make independent decisions, the next obvious question is, what are the decisions we're supposed to make? That becomes our responsibility. Since we have this power, we can assume the responsibility, or we cannot assume the responsibility, but in any case, it's an independent decision. So what are the decisions or the responsibilities we are supposed to make? And that's a dialogue. Because once you establish the first step, that they have the capacity to make independent decisions, then you can start very simply in saying, well, what decisions can you make now that are important? Now, in the clinical field, those decisions are specifically directed towards care of the body or the mind or the emotions. But when we come to soul culture, to spiritual development, those decisions, those responsibilities take on an even greater range of effort. LP, you had your hand up?
Well, just that we make choices and make decisions, but spiritually, we are responsible for those decisions, and it will be carried with us, either as character or skills or a negative. If we focus on trying to fix another, we are failing in our responsibility to life. We should be open if asked, but we're not here to fix each other. We're here to learn and grow and set an example and to allow that sense of knowing, of compassion, to be used in the best way we can. We learn by doing.
Yes, and of course, in general, we all recognizing through the use of our soul capacities and powers, that we recognize the unity and the oneness and the interconnectedness of intelligent life. So naturally, there's a give and take, just as the trees give and take. We recognize that sharing. But the questioner, the original question was related to one's experience in the field where they are responsible, or they've taken on the duty of actively trying to help or guide people in the best way they could improve their condition. So it assumes, therefore, that the person has come to them specifically for advice or instruction as to what they can do to restore their health or well-being. But and to a certain degree, we can all be that kind of physician. We read in the Bible, for example, the phrase attributed to Jesus, "A physician, heal thyself." And in that sense, we are all capable of healing ourselves and helping others. ULT, did you want to follow up with that?
We have a comment here at Theosophy Hall.
Sure.
This comment, it goes back to the question about in a clinical setting, how does one, you know, it had to do with those problems. And the idea came to mind that perhaps it would help to find out what the patient identifies himself as. And, you know, in our world, there are so many people walking around, I'm a person, yes, I happen to have a soul. Well, if that soul is just kind of out there, and all of these ideas we're talking about and these responsibilities are a function of the soul, then maybe the person has to start recognizing that he actually is the soul, and only then he'll be, you know, actively engaged in using these powers of discrimination. But, you know, that's the idea we were thinking.
Does that need to be summarized, or was that heard?
No, we heard that. We'd like to incorporate that comment with a chat that came in mentioning that deciding or disseminating the idea that our responsibility is the ability to make independent decisions. The contribution was that this is what we might call decisional capacity. And yet, it is. And we might say that decisional capacity is expressed by a molecule of oxygen when it prefers and forms strong bonds with nitrogen and hydrogen and not with other molecules. We might also say there's a decisional capacity when crystals form in certain ways or don't in others. And plants make a decisional capacity. Have a decisional capacity when they migrate themselves around cement and stones and toxic areas to find fresh water and sunlight. Certainly bees and other forms of insects make decisional capacities when they're able to go out in swarms and find the sources of nutrition and the nectar that will help them bring back and help the hive. And of course, bees have wonderful decisional capacity when they're able to not only able to make honeycombs in geometrical shapes that most of us could not even draw. So, and then we can go up and up the human kingdom. So what does this say? That decisional capacity is present in all the kingdoms. Therefore, a degree of intelligence is present in all the kingdoms. The difference in the human kingdom is that we have the individual capacity to make decisions independent of the external environment and independent of what the herd decides to do. We can make decisions free from what our instincts and our senses, our prejudicial ideas, our community's ideas have told us. We have a spiritual capacity to stand back and not identify, but to observe the ideas, the options, and decide which way we will go. And we can even choose to go in a way that will personally bring us pain, but we see it's for the greater good. Or we can personally choose to go away, which will bring us pleasure, but we know at the same time will help injure others. And we may or may not feel a sense of pang or remorse or regret for that. These are kinds of independent decisions of the human soul which do not exist in the human, in the lower kingdoms. So the question then comes back to, well, what do we identify ourselves with? do we see ourselves as a body, as a personality that has a soul, something perhaps vague, but something we can recognize the possibility of having, a soul that is lost at death because of the dispersion of the physical atoms of the body and brain? Do we see as the soul as something that's given to us by a supreme being that can be lost, that can be punished, that can be rewarded indefinitely? Do we identify ourselves with that soul? And what the soul has the capacity to do is discern the difference between what this, and this is a faculty and a power of the soul that is not present in any other kingdom. And that's the ability to discern what is temporary and what is permanent, what is enduring and what is here today and will be gone tomorrow. And we might say that that which is real is that which is enduring and permanent. Everything else is illusionary in the sense that it is here today and gone tomorrow. It has no permanent existence. And so what the soul can learn to do is to identify with what is real in itself. Its ability to think, to know, to choose, to experience, to act, all these things can be identified with the soul. The soul can learn to identify with in contrast to those things it recognizes are temporary. Its thoughts, its feelings, its bodily nature, its personality, its relationships, its opinions. It can have those, but it does not become attached or limited by those experiences. It learns from them, but never forgets what it really is, the observer of experience. And that is the greatest capacity and power of the soul, as was mentioned in the talk, the power of judgment, not judging whether we're better than another human being or not judging if another person has good or bad attributes, but judging between that in ourselves first, which is immortal and permanent, and that which is temporary, that which partakes of the nature of spirit and soul, and that which partakes of the nature of form and matter. Both are necessary, but because we grow from those experiences. But that which does the growing, that which carries forth the experience, is different from the experience itself. And that's the basic lesson of theosophy or divine wisdom or spiritual knowledge tries to be put before us to consider. So let's, LP, you want to bring forth another point?
Just that you mentioned this is not available to the lower kingdoms, the power of choice, but we should realize as human beings, it's not available to a higher kingdoms, which are following through on duty and promise. It's only in the human condition that the soul can learn and grow.
Yes. Well, by the power of choice, we do see a certain limited degree of choice in the lower kingdoms, agreed. But we're trying to discern what is the specific kind of choices we can make that's peculiar to the human kingdom. And we can see, even in the human kingdom, there are decisions which we can make as individual human beings that cannot be made once we become part of a collective group. So a police officer, for example, off duty, can make different kinds of decisions than they can once they're on duty. A person who is a clinician can make individual decisions when they're not acting in that capacity and has to make other decisions when they're performing as a physician or a clinician in a hospital setting. A soldier off duty or on leave can make certain kinds of decisions, but when they're in the battalion or the division or the infantry squad, they have to make decisions that are in harmony with the the welfare and the responsibility of the group, not just their own. And so forth, it is in our human development. As we grow in our understanding of our interconnectedness with all of life, we learn that we not only have the responsibility to make decisions that affect our growth individually, but also affect the growth and welfare of the whole. Now, we can't jump there all at once. We may begin to gradually expand that to our family, our neighborhood, our community, our nation, our race. But the highest expression of that, those that we see manifest in the true saviors and inspirers of the faith and religions and philosophies of the world, have had that sense of a responsibility and a universal ethic that incorporates the welfare of all. So then we make decisions from a different perspective. We did want to get back to the initial question of where does imagination fit in with the power and responsibility of the soul? So when we would begin with this thought, if we say responsibility is the ability to make individual decisions, independent decisions, can we decide what we're going to imagine? Are we forced to imagine something? If somebody says to us, well, you may want to go to that place, but it's really bad. It's really bad. Or you may want to read that book, but it's pretty disgusting. Or they may say, well, I know this person and they have some pretty bad faculties, and they describe all this, and they put these ideas of these images in your imagination. Well, do you have the individual capacity to can you accept that image before your mind? Can you imagine that way? Or can you question, check, verify, and if necessary, form a different image in your mind of what the true situation is? So imagination is the picture-making faculty of the mind. And as souls, we have the individual capacity, power, and responsibility to place before our minds those ideas which are the closest approximation we can to what is true, and not just to merely accept what comes before us, which could be deceptive, which could be partial. ULT, you had a question or a comment? Unmute, please.
Yeah, we have one here at Theosophy Hall.
So then, as regards accepting the ideas or the imagination at someone else's suggestion, perhaps that's where the power of the soul comes in. If one is passive, then they may accept that goal, that idea or ideal, as whether it's true or not, because of their passive. However, if they're receptive to ideas and use discrimination, another power of the soul, then they may look at it and decide whether it's going to stay there or not, and perhaps replace it with something that appears to be more true.
So the contribution is there. We can use our soul power of judgment, discernment, what is true, what is not true, what is enduring, what is permanent, what is based on our experience and the experience of many others who've looked into this situation. We can use that to judge the image put before us. Now, if we look in a mirror and we see ourselves there reflected, is that image of what we see in the mirror, would we for a moment assume that that's all we are? We don't think so. One may look in the mirror and they see the image before us, that it's only a expression of our face or our body at that time. And we may look at it and have a completely different perception of what it is than another person looking at it. But we wouldn't assume that that's all we are, because we know that what the mirror doesn't reflect back to us is our motives, our thoughts, our feelings, our experiences, our successes, our failures, those we love, those who love us, all the trials and tribulations, all this, all those things. It doesn't show that. It's within. And so the same thing it is with our imagination. The images that become our before our mind, we have to question. To try to discern based on our wisdom, our experience. And if it does not seem to be true, then our responsibility is to replace those images in our imagination with that are based on our ideas, our ideals, what we do know to be true. And therefore, we take a potentially faulty situation and turn it in an opportunity to be constructed, to be creative in a good way. So even a very difficult situation, one that we might judge as being evil or difficult or unbalanced, if we that presents ourselves to it, if we approach it in the right way, we can use it as an opportunity to create a positive, constructive image, a positive, constructive impulse, and that is a responsibility of the power of the soul. Ideas rule the world, a very ancient idea. And our ideas first rule the kind of images we have in our mind. And from that, we generate the kind of feelings and desires we want to have. And from that, we create our natures, not just our personalities and our physical surroundings and environment, but also the world in which we live. So all these are extensions of our powers of the soul. We do not have to be an adept with the kinds of psychic and spiritual powers we have been studying in the last few weeks in the ocean of theosophy to use the powers of the soul or even our psychic powers. As human beings, we naturally have them because we are beings with a spiritual nature, with a soul nature, with a physical nature. And so just as we learn the powers and capacities of our physical instrument, we can become more familiar with the powers and capacities of our psychic, our inner instruments, and our spiritual nature. Any other questions or comments? Okay, LP?
I certainly appreciate the comments on the difference in a clinical sense of acting within the community and then acting as an individual. We've never reasoned that out before, and we see what a difference that makes. So we, as students of theosophy, have a serious responsibility within the community that we live, our family, our city, our nation. We have to take that responsibility seriously if we want to return in the next incarnation to these ideas.
Yes. And we don't have to wait till the next incarnation. We can take them seriously this week and return next Sunday with the benefit of our experience. Because next Sunday, we're going to see that there is a path of liberation and renunciation. And we are facing that path or just choice, that decision, in fact, every moment of our lives, whether to act towards the path of liberation or renunciation. And of course, discerning of that path is definitely a power of the soul. You're not going to find it in any biology textbook, or you're not going to find it in any external source. It's something that has to be known and appreciated from within. So that should prove to be a very interesting subject. And then once again, this Wednesday, the subject is clairvoyance and clairaudience. And we'll see that they too are aspects of our spiritual and psychic powers. So at this point then, we'd like to thank you for attending and participating in this meeting, and wish you a good week, and look forward to seeing you at our next meeting. Thank you.
This is incredible.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.